Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Well, welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd. I'm here tonight with my co-host, Red Beckman. Well, Red, how are you doing this week?
Well, I spent the afternoon with a weed eater, and it was tough on me. I was chopping a lot of blackberries with him, with that weed eater. But I'm here, and I'm anxiously wanting to hear what our friend Pat has got to say. This is prophecy, I think Bible prophecy, being fulfilled. Right here, we're going to be part of it tonight.
Yeah. Well, I was hoping you were working with a reed eater, getting rid of all of the hairy reeds.
Yeah, his turn's coming. It's going to happen when our Heavenly Father enforces the first and the second commandments. Harry Reid's going to be looking for a place to hide, I suspicion.
He ought to be looking for a place to hide right now.
Oh, yes.
Well,
yeah,
I
don't think it'll be very long now, and we're going to see, some very, very significant things happening.
Red, if you would like to introduce Pat tonight, you're welcome to do that, but before we do that, would you please open us in prayer?
I will do that. Heavenly Father, we thank Thee for the opportunity that You have given to us. The technology that is making it available for us to send out the truth and put it out there. And we just pray that You would give us a big audience out there that is hungry for truth. We know that there's a lot of people in this country that are searching for truth, and what Pat is going to be bringing to our attention tonight is the truth about a terrible, terrible crime committed back there almost 50 years ago. And your prophet Daniel, he said in Daniel 12:4, he said, in the last days, knowledge would increase, and that's what we're going to enjoy tonight. And we just thank You, because You have put us out here where we can communicate with our fellow Americans. And we just pray that You would give us the words to speak and make the words fall on ears that will be glad to hear the truth. So we'll give You the praise now for everything that You've done and everything You're going to do in the near future. We thank Thee for everything. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.
Amen. Amen. And before you introduce Pat, I'd just like to say how pleased I am to have Dr. Kate back on the switchboard tonight playing backup for us, because we have certainly missed you, Dr. Kate, and I just wanted to make sure we got that in right at the front of the show. Go ahead, Red.
Yeah, is Pat present?
Present and accounted for.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Pat Shannon and I go back quite a long ways, and I'll never forget the first time that we met in person. He had arranged for me to come to Atlanta and do some speaking there, and Pat picked me up at the airport and took me to this beautiful, beautiful home. And I was living in a 14-by-70 mobile home back in Montana, and Pat, he's living in a mansion. And this was before the IRS had beat him up pretty bad and stolen what they could. And so it was quite a deal. And you walk in the door, and it was like a three-story atrium. Pat said, "Get your clothes changed and cleaned up because we've got company coming." It was evening, and it was cool. It was in the fall of the year, and they had this big fireplace. And so they thought, well, we'll start a fire. And they started a fire, and there was a bunch of wasps that built a home up in the chimney, and down they came. Most of them had their wings burnt off, and they're crawling all over the floor, and the company was there, and we had all these beautiful southern ladies in their long gowns, and it was just unbelievable. They were walking around the room. Poor Pat, he was embarrassed. His wife was embarrassed, I think. And people are walking around the room, and they're stepping on these big old wasps, and they crunched every time they stepped on one. And so that was how I managed to meet Pat the first time, and we have met many, many times since then. Pat has, sometime we need to get him on when we can tell about how he was prosecuted criminally by the IRS, and he refused to get a lawyer, and he defended himself in a criminal trial with the IRS, and the jury came out and said, not guilty. Oh, my goodness, what a win that was. And we need to have Pat tell us about that sometime. He spent 143 days in jail because they thought he would skip the country or something. But Pat, it is really good to have you here, and I'm really looking forward to this new book because I remember so well the day that John F. Kennedy was assassinated. I was at the neighbor's, and someone came out from the house, and they said John F. Kennedy had just been shot and killed in Dallas, Texas. And the first thing that went through my mind was, who had the most to gain by this? And, of course, by the end of this show, you're going to know who I was thinking, because I was right on target, and millions of my fellow Americans were also on target. And we've lived long enough with this kind of scenario, and it's time we put an end to it. So, Pat, we are sure glad you're here.
Well, thank you. Thanks, Red. Yeah, it's over 30 years now that you and I go back to lunching.
It's a long time.
Yeah. Now your memory is pretty good, but you had one fact wrong about those wasps in the chimney. You see, I like to have exciting openings, and I planted them there.
Oh, I can put that in your resume, can't I?
Yeah, right. Actually, I didn't even remember that part of the episode until you brought it up. But I do remember the night at the big house when you visited. Well, the. I was 23 when Kennedy was shot, so old enough to know what was going on, or at least know what was happening and reading in the newspapers and knowing what was happening there. But, of course, as most Americans, very naively did not have a clue what was going on behind the scenes for some time. But I do remember that nothing smelled right. And the Oswald thing was just, I didn't know what the answer was, but it just seemed like they were giving us the wrong one. And in 1964, the first book to ever come out about it was a small dollar paperback. It was written by a man named Thomas Buchanan. I've never heard of him before or since. I don't know that he ever wrote anything else. But Buchanan wrote a book called Who Killed Kennedy? And I was riding in a car with a friend a long trip up to the northeast from Mississippi, so I had time to read it there in the car when I wasn't driving. And I was intrigued. The book did not have a lot of answers. I still have the same copy, by the way, on my shelf. In fact, I'm looking at a 7-foot-tall, 5-foot-wide bookshelf stacked jam full, in addition to the Life magazines and the Time magazines from November and December, about 100 different videos of the over the past 25 and 30 years when they became popular, and most of them have never been transferred or a CD yet. But I have accumulated quite a collection on the JFK assassination. But that one was the first one, Who Killed Kennedy, and it didn't answer many questions. But by golly, did it have a bunch of questions, and it really made one think, including me. So that's when I took a real interest in learning more about what was going on behind the scenes. And then come September of that year was the Warren Omission Report, and with that I was hooked. That 888 pages of Bravo Sierra was just too much for me, and as you said, probably about a million other Americans. In 1966, then, a man by the name of Richard Popkin came out with a book called The Second Oswald. Now, that really got me stirred, because from that point on, and for about the next 30 years, many of us, including myself, smelled a rat. We knew there probably was some kind of second or maybe even a third Oswald running around out there, but never really knew how much he might look alike. The fact was that someone representing Lee Harvey Oswald was, for instance, driving a car on Stemmons Freeway in Dallas with a used car salesman or new car salesman saying, my name's Lee Harvey Oswald. I'm going to come into a lot of money here pretty soon, and I'm going to be able to buy this car. And then he races up and down Stemmons Freeway at 80 miles an hour to attract attention. And there was two problems with that. The Lee Harvey Oswald that we knew later that Jack Ruby shot never had a driver's license. And besides that, in 1961, he was in Russia, marrying Marina, and something was wrong with the story from there. Earlier than that, and even later than that, and as late as the week of the assassination, Lee Harvey Oswald, while he was at work at the Texas School Book Depository, was also out at the shooting range, for instance, and making a real pest of himself, shooting the targets of other people. And of course, he had signed in as Lee Harvey Oswald, and he made a big name, a big fact of that, to what his name was. He made sure everybody heard that. And yet he's supposed to be at work, and he was at work at the Texas School Book Depository downtown. So all these things were known back in 1966, but it really wasn't known who and what and where. And for 30 years, the one that really bugged me the most was, how can a 17-year-old high school dropout join the Marines, go to language school for 6 weeks in Japan, which he may or may not have even done. Some of the military brass denies this. But go to language school for 6 weeks and come out speaking Russian so fluently that when he does go to Russia in 1959 and he meets his future bride, Marina, he speaks the language so fluently that she believes him to be a native. That one was too much even for Oswald's junior high school principal and school teachers in Fort Worth, and certainly was too much for me. So for 30 years, you know, so many of us believed that there had to have been two Oswalds, but never in our wildest dreams did we believe that they looked so much alike that they almost looked like twins, yet they were not blood related. And, of course, one of them, it ended up, did speak fluent Russian, and he was the son of either Russian immigrant parents or maybe even a Russian war orphan from Hungary or thereabouts. And, of course, Lee, we know, was born in New Orleans on October 18, 1939, of Marguerite. The problem was the Marguerite Oswald that you and I knew in 1963 after the assassination, who stood up on television and spoke, by the way, not only without a New Orleans accent, but also without even a Southern drawl, nor any kind of Russian accent either. No foreign accent is in her. You can still pick her up on YouTube and hear what I'm talking about right now. So all these things made her out to be a fraud and an imposter and someone who undoubtedly had adopted what my source, the greatest researcher in the history of the world, I reckon, and certainly by far in this case, John Armstrong, finally put together. And this is the reason for my book, because John Armstrong's work is superb to anyone else's on the research of this case. It's painstaking. I remember when I first picked up his book a decade ago, and I got into it, and Armstrong hammers home the details so much that you want to say, okay, I believe you. Go on to something else, man. You sold me. And but he just goes right on to the minutest of details on his research, and it's really an incredible job. What he did, it's 1,000 pages. He's even got a CD in there now with the pictures and stuff of Harvey and Lee, and that's the name of his book, incidentally, and I thought that was a piece of brilliance also of naming his book Harvey and Lee, because otherwise it's just impossible to distinguish between which Oswald one is talking about. And I used to, as I said in the book, my new book, that I used to just describe him as one as being one with the bull neck, the more marine-looking, spit and polish, better-looking, taller, more muscular Oswald. And the other one was a skinnier, shorter, thinner-haired. But that, of course, was Harvey, and the first one I just mentioned was Lee. And Harvey and Lee is a much better way, in my opinion, of distinguishing between the two. Now, moving on up to how they were utilized, the Lee's mother, this would be the real Oswald, if you want to call it. And by the way, for those who are listening and wondering, you know, what happened on November 22nd in 63 and then 2 days later on Sunday morning, it was not Lee Oswald that Jack Ruby shot in the jailhouse. It was Harvey, the Russian-speaking individual who had gone to Russia, came home with Marina, and went two little girls. So let's lay that part of the platform down now so people can understand where we're coming from a little bit. Lee's mother in 1952 she was widowed and actually divorced again, and in 1952 went to New York City and took a job, and it was at that time probably that somebody began to notice how much he looked like this Russian kid who was running around the streets, too. Now, this is speculation. We're not exactly sure how they were brought together. Others claim that because Robert Oswald, Lee's older brother, born in 34, making him 20 in 54, was contacted after these two had kind of melded together in New York City, and someone asked Robert and showed him this picture, and he said, yeah, boy, he does look like me, but I'll tell you, he looks a whole lot more like my little brother. And in fact, he's closer to the same age. And this may be also how they were actually brought together. That part is a little vague. But what is known, thanks to John Armstrong's great research, is that when the New York Armstrong, the New York Harvey, S. by Armstrong, moved down to New Orleans in 54 when Lee was still in New York. And when Lee comes back into New Orleans, because his mother has to move back there, she's not very wealthy, and she's, you know, has to work in as a shopkeeper and these sorts of things in New Orleans at a couple of different stores, department stores. And they were actually were in junior high school together by this time, not together, but at different junior high schools in New Orleans. He has tracked down their actual addresses, and we now have a man by the name of Palmer McBride, and he is now in the new edition of the book with his picture. And Palmer McBride plays a very, very important part in this for a couple of reasons. Number one, he was Harvey's best friend and went to high school with him, and even late junior high, I believe. And he used to go to Harvey's mother's house and have lunch with him. He remembered that Harvey was quite an intellectual, and they talked a lot about some of the deeper things, about how Eisenhower was failing in the space program, because now with Sputnik up in October of 57, the Russians were outrunning us. And so they had those kinds of scholarly conversations, and he remembered him very well. He was his best friend. Well, we have a letter now in the book from Palmer McBride to David Lifton. Now, the closer followers and readers on the Kennedy assassination will immediately recognize David Lifton's name. He was the one that wrote a wonderful book 30 years ago, about 1980, called Best Evidence. And his book pretty much centered around the deception by the doctors. After the body left Dallas, there was no deception by the Parkland Hospital doctors, but after it left Dallas, there was, and I'm sure both of you people have read the deception that went on with the carving up of the skull and the brain and trying to put the hair back on the back of the head so the hole wasn't so big, and all these sorts of things that went on. Well, David Lifton did a wonderful job on this, but sometimes egos get out of control, and Lifton took umbrage at the fact when Armstrong brought Palmer McBride with him to one of the Dallas meetings that are held every November in Dallas, and had him stand beside him on stage and actually speak and tell his story, who he was and what he knew about Harvey. David Lifton was a little upset that Palmer McBride would either be this deceptive or just mistaken, and he went public with the fact, and I in fact even accused him of deception, we shall say, and went public with the fact that it was impossible for him to have gone to high school in 1957 with Oswald and to work with him in 58 at the Pfister Dental Labs because he was in Japan in the Marines in 1956, and Lifton had the records to prove it. Well, what has happened here is David Lifton actually accomplished exactly what he intended not to, and that was to prove that indeed there were two Oswalds. Of course Oswald was in the Marines in Japan in 1956, but it wasn't Harvey, it was Lee. And in 57 and 8, when Palmer McBride worked with him in New Orleans, Harvey then joins the Marines. And this is when the melding of the two really was going into one. And by 1958, Lee had pretty much disappeared behind the scenes, as well as his mother. We now also have pictures of both Marguerites in our new book. And thanks again to John Armstrong, he had pointed out how the Marguerite that we knew on television in 1963 was 15 years older than Lee's mother. And as I point out, that would have made her 47 years old when Lee was born in 1939, which would not necessarily be impossible, but awfully inordinate. Lee's mother was not seen very much at all after about 59 or so in New Orleans, and by 1963, when the Lee Harvey Oswald name is flashed all over the world and Marguerite is on television claiming her son was framed and worked for the FBI and making all these noises, those are the films that can still be seen, by the way, on YouTube. Lee's mother's friends back in New Orleans are saying, who is this woman? That's not the Margie we knew. So what happened was Lifton, by complaining and attempting to make a fool of McBride, actually made McBride in Armstrong's case for them as well. Well, I'm getting down to the important part, I guess, of the 1963 assassination and some of the things that went on that day and the few days before. But while I have a drink of water, would either of you gentlemen like to, for me to clarify anything that I've said so far that might have been confusing?
It's all yours, Terry.
I guess I better unmute myself, huh?
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
I don't really need clarification on what you just said. I've just got a tremendous amount of questions and a lot of ground to cover tonight because, you know, you guys have told your story. I was in the seventh grade or I think sixth or seventh grade when it happened. And, you know, it was kind of surreal to me, but, you know, from what I had read and everything, I didn't really care a whole lot about the Kennedys until about 6 or 7 years ago, about the time when I really, really started waking up to what was really going on out there. And it's amazing to me how much I've learned in the last, you know, 6 years or so about this. I've learned a lot more than I ever knew back then, even though I was, you know, I remember it too. I remember well sitting in class and them turning on the TV in the classroom, which was one of the first TVs we ever had in the classroom, and I happened to be in one that they had it there. So it was an interesting time, but it really didn't interest me until recent years. And one of the things that I'm going to want to get into eventually, but not right this second, but eventually, Pat, is how this applies to us today. I mean, because, you know, we might have some listeners on here that are not as old as we are, and this really wasn't a part of their lives that they have recall of, and they're probably wondering, well, how does this apply to me today? And eventually, before the show's over with, I'd kind of like to see us, you know, bring it forward and explain to people why this is so important today, because it is very important for people to understand this. It's going to really, really help people get an idea of the other things that have happened since then, because I believe it can all be tied together. Did you get your drink of water?
I did. And yes, you're right. To me, there are two very important reasons that this story be told now. The first one, and most imminent, is the fact that, without a doubt, there's going to be, and it's already begun, such a barrage of news deception between now and the 50th anniversary in November. And that's why someone urged me back at Thanksgiving last year. He said, I wish you would write a whole book about that chapter you have on the two Oswalds in your last book, because the 50th anniversary is coming up, and you know it's going to be worse than ever. And I got to thinking, and I said, no, he's right. He's right, because we are continually fed the lies. In fact, only this afternoon there was an insurance man by, and a young fella, and who was giving me a quote. And we got to rapping about, oh, we got down to my library, and he noticed this. Oh, he said, oh, man, what a great library. I'm a reader. I like books. I was a history major. I said, what? You were a history major? He said, yeah. And I said, did they ever tell you that anybody? I said, no, did they tell you that Oswald killed Kennedy? He said, well, yeah. And so, bingo, we were off and running. But that's, see, the deception that the youth of America are being taught. And just the other day, somebody was saying to me that how we have two generations of dumbed-down Americans. They're not dumb Americans, but they've been dumbed down by education. And so that is a reason that I'm talking to you tonight, Red, excuse me, Terry, because we know from our experience the mainstream media are never going to tell the truth about the things that they've been lying about over the years. And we can rest assured we will never get them to tell us the truth about 9-1-1. We're never going to hear the truth about TWA, and even though finally some whistleblowers have come forward, that will never come out. That, you know, I just don't believe it's going to ever be told. And I've said for the last 20 years, if they've been covering up the Kennedy assassination for this long, you can bet that these other things, the Oklahoma City bombing, which I covered, we know was an inside job. We know that the bombs were on the inside of the building right above the nursery designed to murder the children. We know that Tim McVeigh did not do that. But you're never going to get a false flag operation exposed by those who pulled it off. And so that's why I also say at the end of the book that this is another reason that the new generation needs to know that these sorts of questionable activities, such as the Aurora, Colorado shooting right there in your backyard, where, you know, we got people, 12 people wounded in the theater next door with a 12-foot wall between them. There had to be more than one shooter, period. What about the Connecticut shooting? We have never seen any pictures of the dead body of the alleged assassin. And yet we do have a lot of suspicion, a lot of questions, a lot of questionable evidence, but nobody's saying anything. What about the Boston Marathon? And now we got over 300 people who signed up for hospital care. You can't see 300 people in that video standing near either one of those blasts. There are not that many people there. So this is another way that the news media will blow out of proportion some of the things that need to be done. I'm not saying the Boston thing didn't happen. I'm not saying kids didn't die in Connecticut, but I say the media do have a way of exaggerating the results in order to get sympathy. And that is the second reason that this thing must be exposed, and here is our chance because with, as I started to say earlier, I'm contacting people like Terry and other people, talk show hosts, because we must spread the word this way. And the book tells the whole story. It's has so much evidence that anyone who reads the book can laugh in the face of any newsman who wants to tell us that Oswald killed Kennedy. And so we must get this message out by way of talk show, internet, and other means of mouth to mouth. By getting the truth out on this, we can make people think about all the future false flags that are going to be coming down.
Well, let's talk a little bit about who really did this? Who was behind this? We should start with the Clint Murchison meeting and talk a little bit of maybe about what Madeline Brown brought out and what Russell Bowen brought out.
Well, fine. You know, I first learned of the Murchison meeting from Russell Bowen. Russell Bowen being a CIA colonel at the time, was later promoted to general at the end of his career, but Russ was, he was born in 1924, so he was just a 21-year-old pilot when the war ended, and he had been working with Wild Bill Donovan, and so he was a natural to be drafted right into the CIA in 1947 when he was 23, when it was begun by Truman. So he was CIA literally all his adult life. And Russell Bowen has some hair-raising stories, and as I mentioned in the book, I used to sit down with him around his pool in Winter Haven and or meet him at his favorite restaurant there in Lakeland. We had lots of good in-depth conversations. Now, I had been told by another friend of his that he had lots of information, was a participant as a pilot flying in the assassins into Dallas. But I never could get him to go beyond saying that he called it a triangular assassination team that he had flown in. But whenever I would try to question him further, he would just dodge the question. Finally, he'd get a little perturbed with me, and he'd say, "No, Pat, I'm telling you, you know, just don't ask me about that." I said, "Russ, how about we just put it on tape and put it up? We don't even put it on tape. Just let me write it down and we'll put it in a safe somewhere, and we won't report it until after you're gone." He said, "Nope, they'll find out." I mean, he just would not want to go anywhere near that except beyond telling me about the night before at Clint's house. And he used to have great laugh, as I said in the book, about Nixon and Bush, the only two guys in America who couldn't remember where they were on the day Kennedy was killed. And of course, he said, I was with both of them at Clint Murchison's house the night before it happened. And I had read a sniff of that just a couple of years before. It had appeared in I don't know, it was Jim Mars's book, or I can't even remember where, but it was so vague that even the author wasn't quite sure that it had happened, but that was the rumor. Well, now here he is confirming, and he's the first one to tell me that he was there. And he had flown what he called, as I said, the triangular assassination team into Dallas, flew him in and flew him out. And at Murchison's house, he confirmed that everybody who was anybody in Washington who was not a Kennedyite was at that party. And it was a business meeting, really, with a few drinks before, and they went into the smoke-filled conference room after Lyndon Johnson arrived about 10 o'clock. Lyndon had, of course, had a banquet with the Kennedys in Fort Worth earlier and then had jumped in his limo and probably got from Fort Worth to Dallas as fast as a helicopter, nearly, in those days. But he indeed did show up, and this, I don't think the planning was going on there. I think just maybe the finer touches were put on, or maybe some of these people are being informed what to look for tomorrow without telling them too much. You know Madeline's story later when Lyndon came out and, you know, told her that pretty much what was happening. But I had never had anybody tell me what Russell Bowen had just told me in 1994-95. And in 1998, there was a book expo going on in Dallas where I was. And on Sunday, all of the vendors, I was actually there representing Media Bypass magazine at their booth. But all of the vendors have a habit of snooping around over the weekend, deciding, you know, whose stuff they want to trade with. And so we always trade books for books or books for vitamin pills or whatever. And so I had ambled over to this table. There was a big, big book section at this particular table. I mean, there were you know, a couple of hundred books on the shelf. And they really had a big operation. And there was this elderly lady sitting there at the table. And I said, introduced myself, and I said, I've got a book here. I'd like to trade maybe for some of yours. And she said, well, the lady who runs this is not here. I don't have anything to do with those, but I do have this one book of mine. And she said, my name is, I'm Madeline Duncan Brown, and I said, Lyndon Johnson's girlfriend. I just spit it right out. And she said, yes. I said, my goodness, your reputation precedes you. And so we were out for a while, and we traded books, and I took it back home, and just a day or two later, I couldn't wait to get into it. And in the early pages, she mentions to me for the second time the evidence of the Clint Murchison party. He had called her in the afternoon to come by and have a few drinks and kind of socialize. And she was a social butterfly. And in fact, she knew Jack Ruby. She used to hang out at the Carousel Club, she told me. And here she was, 75 years old or so, and telling me all this. And I said, well, did you ever dance there? And she kind of gave me a sly grin and a wink, and she said, no, but I always wanted to. But at 75, she still had a great personality and great mind and memory. And she told me that, indeed, while she was sitting there after the party had started, after Lyndon had come in from Fort Worth and they all had gone into the smoke-filled room, here comes Jack Ruby. And she said, now, Pat, I don't want you to think that Jack Ruby was there helping these guys plan. And she said, I don't know anything about that. But Jack Ruby always was on hand. Everybody in these bigwigs knew him, just like the cops knew him and the district attorney and everybody else knew him from his club. But when the bigwigs came to town, Jack Ruby became the supplier of their women. And that's why Jack was there. He came by, and as Russell confirmed, yeah, he dropped off a couple of broads. And he had a quick drink, she said, with him, and they rapped for a minute, and then he took off. So, indeed, it took me 4 years, but I did have confirmation that, indeed, the Clint Murchison meeting did take place, and somebody was writing, I was reading the other day, I think it might be Richard Mack, the two-faced Richard Mack, who is, I don't want to spend any time on the negative, but here's a guy who was a researcher on this stuff with Jack White, the photographer, back in the 80s. I've got him on video talking. He's pointing out the badge man and the bushes, and I mean, here's a guy that turned 180 degrees because of the filthy lucre, and he got him a job at the Texas School Book Depository where he can't talk about conspiracy anymore. And so now he's saying that he didn't believe there even was a meeting. At there's no evidence that anybody was there. Nobody's ever come forward. And he wants to knock the fact that it was Madeline Brown was making it up. Well, the Bible says out of the mouths of two or three witnesses, and I got two. I got my second one and Madeline Brown in 98, but I already had Russell Bowen who was there. So that's good enough for me.
Well, I thought Madeline Brown's comment was pretty candid. I never thought it was contrived when she said that night after the bigwigs had met and LBJ came out, and he had said to her, "That SOB will never embarrass me again."
Yeah, those Kennedys.
I thought that was very telling, because she didn't just tell what she saw. She expressed that with sincerity. And you know, for those who don't know, LBJ and Kennedy never had lost any love between each other, because Kennedy was forced really to allow LBJ to run as his VP in order to get the support of the people he needed in order to get the candidacy.
And well, not only that, but he was blackmailed into taking Johnson. He had already chosen Stuart Symington back in July of 60, and in fact, he had told Symington that he was his choice. And he and Bobby, it was a done deal. And then suddenly, about 2 o'clock in the morning, he gets a call from Sam Rayburn, and I guess Clint Murchison was probably there behind the scenes as well. And they saying that they're going to have to put LBJ on the ticket. Well, this just reeks of a future plan. You know, it reminds me the story of Ronald Reagan being flown to New York after he got the nomination in 80. He's flown out of New York allegedly and by Rockefeller and by David Rockefeller, who meets with him and said, "If you don't put George Bush on your ticket, then you're never going to see the inside of the White House except as a tourist." And once again, as everyone well knows, the money people control both parties, so he certainly would have had the power to do that, even as popular as Reagan was. So, with 9 weeks later, Reagan almost being removed, that told me why he had to put George Bush on the ticket. This, going back, you know, 20 years earlier, it was the same situation. Kennedy was forced to put Johnson on the ticket, and of course Hoover had a dossier on him. He could have destroyed him, his reputation. They blackmailed him into taking Johnson. And once they had to get rid of him, then, of course, they had a cooperative new president who's going to take care of the cover-up by appointing people like Alan Dulles, the CIA guy who was fired, stick him on the Warren Commission, put J. Edgar Hoover on there, so every time a new lie shows up, I mean, gets uncovered, they can cover it up with a new one.
Pat, would you mind connecting the dots between Murchison and the Bush family?
No, I can't do that. You and I talked about that casually, but I don't have the details on that. Webster Tarpley would be the guy to have on. He's written a great unauthorized biography.
I wasn't talking about that. I was talking about the fact that Murchison was partners and business associates with Prescott Bush.
Oh, you're talking about on the oil side. Oh, yeah, from the oil side of it. But remember, George is still a young guy. He was CIA, so, I mean, this is why he was in Dallas. And, in fact, back to the Madeline Duncan story and the Murchison house party, when I read in her book confirming that I jumped out of my chair and ran on the telephone and I called her. And the first thing I wanted to ask her, I said, "Were George Bush and Henry Kissinger there?" And she, because this is what Russell Bowen had told me, but both Bush and Murchison were such obscure characters in 1963, they really weren't very recognizable. And she just had to say, Pat, I don't know. I didn't know what either one of them looked like in those days. But Bowen told me that, you know, Kissinger was a young protege of Rockefeller's, so he very well probably was traveling with Nixon, who knows, but was there as well. To me, the more intriguing oil connection with George H.W. Bush goes to George de Morenschild, who was his partner in business. They go way, way back. Now, why is this important? Because he became Oswald's, and that would be Harvey's, handler when he got back to Fort Worth in 1962. He returned to Fort Worth, and George befriended him. Obviously, he was assigned to be his handler because they both spoke fluent Russian. So I know a little bit more, I guess, about that connection. And of course, George de Morenschild was fine. He was cool. He kept his mouth shut and avoided all kinds of early demises, as so many others suffered, until 1977, when the new House Committee began to meet, and he was subpoenaed. And so rather than go, he decided he'd shotgun himself, or what I call he was suicided.
But not until he got a subpoena, correct?
Oh, yeah. He was supposed to appear in a few days. Same with the others I mentioned in there, you know, the Chicago mobsters, old Sam Giancana, and the others that, well, of course, there's about 100 in there, Jim Mars covers of the suspicious deaths that came down after the fact, but very soon. You know, Mark Lane was one of the early researchers and actually investigators and investigative reporter on the case, and he did some great work. But I remember way back, he had discovered that there were like 153 or something odd number like that of people who were actually witnesses on the grassy knoll, standing there, hearing, seeing the shots, watching the president die, wherever. And of those 153, 18 were dead in 18 months. So he wrote to Prudential Life Insurance Company, to their actuarial department, and asked them to take an imaginary scenario of 153 people are together, various ages, various health, whatever, just 153 people stuck together, we'll say, at a high school football game. And that's how many are there. And 18 of those people are dead in 18 months. What are the actuarial odds? Mark Lane wanted to know. And the number came out astronomical, in the trillions, as being impossible. So, of course, there were all kinds of assassinations going on, and people were learning to keep their mouths shut. And as I say in the new book on the Harvey and Lee synopsis, the book is called The JFK Assassination and the Uncensored Story of the Two Oswalds. And it's a long title, but it's important that those pictures be on the cover and people understand what they're looking at. But as as we point out in the book, the astronomical number of people that were dying in the early months, and even, you know, say early months, that's significant. But when it's 25 years later and someone is, you know, dies, that to me, that's not real important. So what we pointed out in the book is the second 25 years of the past 50, we have learned so much more because so many more people were willing to talk and tell what they knew. They lost their fears as time wore on, and they wanted to get their stories out. Almost such as the guy who was in the movie theater. And when Harvey was arrested downstairs, he was afraid to tell for 15 years, and he told the Dallas Morning News in 1979, so good 15 years later, he told them what he did not tell the Warren Commission and intentionally did not tell them, was that between him and Oswald in the theater city, there was a guy by the name of Jack Ruby. And of course, he didn't know Ruby on Friday, but he certainly did by Sunday afternoon, didn't he? Or knew who he was. So these sorts of things that are the type of things that have come out in recent years. Now, let's talk a little bit about the day or the couple days preceding. One of the most interesting stories, I guess, is one of the lesser known, and that's the story of Harvey going to the Texas Employment Commission, and he meets a lady by the name of Laura Cottrell, who's working there for the state and interviewing him for a job, and he takes the job on the spot and goes to work, in fact, the next day at the Texas School Book Depository, working there as a warehouse guy, stacking books or boxing them or unboxing them. And a month later, Oswald comes back in the office and meets Laura Cottrell, of all people. Now, as I say in the book, why would anybody be so foolish as to want to do this? And but Armstrong says it might have had something to do with Lee attempting to preserve a welfare check that he had been receiving. But in any case, I thought it was pretty stupid. But it also indicated to me that maybe, and we're 5 weeks and a month, Harvey went to work 5 weeks before the assassination, so we're still a month away from the assassination. It indicates to me that perhaps even Lee didn't know exactly what Harvey was going to be used for at that time. Once again, speculation. But Lee, at this time, remember, had slipped through the cracks in 1958, and especially when Harvey went to Russia in 59, Lee is nowhere to be found anymore. They disappeared him, and there became one, Lee Harvey Oswald, and it was Harvey in Russia. But Lee was still, obviously, on the CIA payroll. He was working behind the scenes, and strangely, when Harvey went to New Orleans in April of 63, Lee came back into Dallas. And we know this from witnesses, seeing him with Jack Ruby and others. And for some reason, Robert Oswald moved to Malvern, Arkansas. And I'm not sure of that connection yet. I should have dug that out already, because I imagine it's in the index and deep pages somewhere of Armstrong's book, but it's a lot easier for me to just confer with him when I can. But now Harvey is down in New Orleans, and this is when he meets Judith Baker. She calls him Lee, but he really is not Lee. He is Harvey, the Russian-speaking Oswald. Marina's still back in Fort Worth. They don't have much money. He's down there doing something, allegedly looking for a job and getting a job, but his job wasn't any better than it was, what he was doing back in Fort Worth. So it was menial work and small paycheck. So he was there for some other reason and working there at the coffee company, and he meets Judith, and that's a whole different story. But when he returns to Dallas in October, Lee disappears into the cracks again. He's not to be found. So they were maneuvering these people even way, way back in the school days. When one would be in Fort Worth, the other would be in New Orleans in school. It just is something straight out of the, what should we say, CIA tales or some TV program you wonder how these writers can even make these things up, but truth is even stranger than fiction. Now we're at Texas School Book Depository, October of 63, and Lee is out at the target range making a fool of himself, or he's driving a car and claiming he's going to be buying it soon. And Harvey, come November 22nd, is standing in the front door of the school book depository at the moment Kennedy is shot. Now, there's a website there called Oswald's Innocent, and Dr. Ralph Sinkay, Jim Fetzer, several other people have endorsed his work and are showing, and we portray it in the book, of how Billy Lovelady, who did look someone like Oswald, was actually standing next to him, and they have switched the heads, they've switched the shoulders, and the photographic evidence has obviously been tampered with, showing a couple of things. Number one, that they knew where Oswald was the whole time, and so they knew he was in that doorway at the moment of the shooting, and they had to do something with that, because the picture, Jim Fetzer tells me, also one of the great last decade researchers, is Jim Fetzer for sure, and professor at the University of Minnesota, just retired. But Fetzer says that the picture taken by the Associated Press photographer was not published in the evening edition, as so many of the other pictures were. They saved it and doctored it all night long, and it did not appear until Saturday's newspaper, even though it was taken, of course, Friday afternoon, right then at 12:30. They had it when they had all the others. So this makes for a very, very intriguing new chapter to the whole case of the cover-up. I'm imagining the news media already being in on the cover-up before the shots are fired, of course. I also was wondering, and as I do in the book, how could a obscure street reporter from Houston by the name of Dan Rather have privy to see the Zapruder film on Friday night? He was the first reporter to see it. And why would they even allow him in there unless he was already some of the anointed? Was he already CFR? Was he already an insider? Apparently he must have been, because he was very, very well rewarded over the next 40 years before he retired with, a seat in front of CBS News cameras as anchor reader that, paid a few million bucks a year. He was probably the highest rewarded individual in the whole case over the years. But why was he there? Why was he allowed there? That's the only answer I can come up with. Another intriguing thing is, okay, why did they kill Kennedy? Well, I have kind of a facetious answer to that today, but yet it's still accurate. They killed Kennedy because, I should put it this way, John F. Kennedy got killed because he thought he was president. Now, what I mean is he didn't know the powers behind the scenes until much too late, and he was stepping on their toes. And I'm telling you, it was 1983, I guess, before I began to realize why Kennedy was really killed. And it's because he was not one of them. Back in the 60s, he was a liberal Democrat. He was shoving integration down the throats of the Southern schoolers faster than they wanted to swallow it. He was not popular. And it took me some time to, I guess, discern the difference between a liberal and an insider. And so Kennedy may have been a liberal, but he was not an insider, and he was taken out. Oh, we got multiple choice here. Was he taken out because of the oil depletion allowance? That's a popular one, and with Clint Murchison working behind the scenes, that certainly could have been an advantage to him and Hunt, father, and H.L. Hunt and sons. A lot of people want to point to the money, and Terry, you and I have discussed this briefly about the executive order 11110. But I like to point out, because I believe that and reported that for some time, but I don't think that was really the motive anymore, because it referred to the silver certificates and not Federal Reserve notes. And although it was giving a slight advantage, or taking, I would say, an advantage away from the Federal Reserve, I don't think that in itself was the reason. There are, as I say, probably half a dozen. Oh, we got to have the Israeli connection. You know, he and David Ben-Gurion, they were at odds. Ben-Gurion wanted money and wanted the bomb, and this sort of thing. Kennedy didn't want him to have it. So that we've always got that Mossad tie-in. But I think the real motivation, the biggest piece to the puzzle, would have been the Vietnam War. And a lot of people don't remember that Kennedy was pulling out of Vietnam in 63. He had already ordered home 1,000 advisors, as they called them, and he's going to have everybody home by the end of 64. Well, that's a big deal. You're talking about billions of dollars that the military-industrial complex earns from war. They love wars. Imagine you get to build an airplane and crash it, and bingo, you knocked out a few million dollars in 1 minute, and they get to build a new one. Bombs, of course, the same way. So the banksters make just jillions on war, and as we can see what happened the following year, by 1965, Johnson had moved 500,000 men into Vietnam. The result pretty much shows what the plans must have been. So that's my number one choice for motivation, and it has been for many years. I believe it was the Vietnam War that was at least the straw that broke the camel's back to get rid of Kennedy and move in Johnson.
Well, I have to say that the one thing that convinced me and when I say they, I'm referring to your book, Everything They Ever Told Me Was a Lie. I use that capital T with an asterisk on it a lot because it clearly defines who they are. And when he started talking about who they are and talking about the military, the industrial military complex, and his speeches that he gave shortly before they took him out. That's what really thoroughly convinced me that there's no doubt who took him out. But the common thread, and you and I talked about this, the common thread with all of the presidents that have been taken out was their opposition of the central bank. And they tried to take Jackson out for that reason. He was, four or five times they tried to kill him. And it's a common thread with all of the presidents. So, you can start another war if you've got the money and the power and the influence and own the media and all of that. You can start another war. But they really had to work at getting control of our money supply. And that's the one thing they could not afford to let him take away from them. So I believe in that all of the reasons that you've mentioned, plus some more. I think there's a few others. I think him blocking that one piece of legislation that would give them some more control, because there was a conspiracy going on with them taking their tax-exempt foundations, taking over the education system. And Kennedy blocked some of that. So I believe that the Israel issue, I believe that the Vietnam issue, I believe the central bank and money issue and the education issue, and there's even a few others that I believe were reasons why they did it. But the one that brings the common thread together for me is the opposition to the central bank.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, of course, they accomplished the same thing. Whatever their motivation was, they accomplished it, didn't they? But the central bank, of course, also was the greatest beneficiary of the continuing of the Vietnam so-called war.
Right. Absolutely. Now I mentioned the Zapruder film to you, and you had made some comments. You thought that had been doctored, and I'm not talking about doctoring from the damage that was done when the magazine. People damaged it. I'm referring, by referring to other changes that might have been made in that film. You think it was messed with?
Oh yes, I've thought that and believed that for a long, long time. And once again, Dr. James Fetzer has done the most recent research on that and publishing of it, and it's on his website. I'm sorry, I don't have it in front of me, but it's in the book. But he points out the. For instance, the facts of the witnesses pointing out that the car came to a complete stop right there in the kill zone. So we know that William Greer and Bill Kellerman, who was a special agent in charge riding shotgun on the right, Bill Greer was a driver. We know that they had foreknowledge. They knew that they were performing what they were supposed to do. But on the Subverter film, you don't see the car stop. You see it slow down a lot more than it should. But that was a biggie that Fetzer points out. And he's got so many more examples and proofs there of the doctoring of the film. And, of course, they had to do that to make the magic bullet theory appear valid. And still didn't make it appear valid to me, but I think it did to the general public. Let me tell you a story about that. I just reminded myself, because so many people, and it's hit the Internet in recent months again, these things have a way of raising their ugly heads. But the rumor that it was a driver who shot Kennedy, I imagine you've heard that. And that was begun, actually, by a guy named William Cooper. Bill Cooper used to have a talk show host, and now I hate to speak ill of the dead, because I think he was probably a good man at heart, and he certainly died fighting the constabulary. But Cooper continued to push this film, this video, about the watch the driver. The driver turns around and shoots Kennedy right at the precise moment. Well, those films, when they are enhanced and blown up, show that Greer's hands never even leave the steering wheel. I think one is in his lap for a moment, but his hand is on the steering wheel. He's turning around and looking at the president, probably seeing if he's been hit yet, because after all, he did stop the car to set him up. And the what appears to be like a .45 automatic in his hand is actually the reflection of William Kellerman, the special agent in charge of the Secret Service. He's riding, as I say, in the right front seat. It's the top of his head, and the sun glaring off of it does appear to be a chrome pistol. But it simply was not true. That is not the case. Greer did not shoot a gun, but I definitely think he was a conspirator.
I think everybody in that car was.
Not Jackie. You think Jackie was? You don't buy that story about her doing the shooting, do you?
I believe it's possible.
Well, of course it's possible, but that just didn't happen. Another guy wrote and published a whole book. One of the stupidest things I've ever seen, where Kennedy was actually, they had a collapsible back seat, and he was dragged into the back seat and into the trunk and disappeared back there. I got that one on my shelf. I forget the name of it, but it's ridiculous, some of the theories that people come up with. And another one has just raised its ugly head of the Secret Service agent accidentally shot Kennedy. And that was just come back out again. I've had to send that out to a few people asking about it. I said, well, first of all, it's 20 years old since the book came out. And how ridiculous that one AK-47 or whatever it was in the Secret Service car riding behind Kennedy could have made all those bullet holes, one accidental shot. So the whole theory is absolutely asinine.
Well, this is a little off base, and you can tell me to go take a flying leap, but I'd like to hear you, with all the research that you've done, just what your theory is. And I'm saying it's a theory. I'm saying that it's, that just on your speculation, how do you really think this came down? If you were describing the scene as you believe it happened, how would you describe it?
Okay. Let me preempt that with a quote I didn't know until recent years, and it was from the new CIA director, William Casey, in his first staff meeting in 1981. And he is quoted as saying, "We'll know our disinformation program is complete when everything the American public believes is false." Now, that was in 1981. 30 years later down the road, boy, are we seeing that exemplified. So Of course, everything that they've told us about the Kennedy assassination has been a lie. And as I say in the book, and I've said to you in the past, that without the collaboration of a news media, because we just don't have investigative reporters anymore in the mainstream media, but without that cooperation and actually collaboration, they just could not have gotten away with that. So that's an important thing that they have to have on their side in the beginning. Another one is cooperation of the investigative agencies. So, in other words, the people who pull the thing off are the ones who are going to be investigating it, and that's the way it's going to be covered up pretty easily. And I think we've seen several of those in really the last year or two. The Kennedy assassination on November 22nd was we got videos of the Secret Service agent at Love Field. I'm sure you've seen that one. He's being pulled off of his job. His boss tells him, flags him back, and pulls him back, and he kind of shrugs his hands like, are you crazy? And so here we've got Kennedy and the Connollys pulling away from the airport in the open-top limousine, totally unprotected. And that's the way they went down the street all the way into Dallas when they turned west on Main Street. It was the same. It was a very, very friendly reception. The last words that Nellie Connolly said to President Kennedy was, you can't say that Dallas doesn't love you, Mr. President. And that was just a few seconds before the first shot was fired. Now, if someone, Oswald, as they claim, had been in that southeast six-story window, when they turned right on Houston Street, they only go about 100 yards and take another left. I've been to the scene many, many times, and the obvious place for a single lone nut assassin to shoot the president is right there. As it turns right in Houston, this game is driving straight toward the window, and Ford takes a left on Elm Street, and there is the perfect target for a single shot to blow him right through the head. Of course, it wasn't fired because he wasn't in the kill zone, and of course, Oswald wasn't in the window, the only shots that might have been fired from there later, a few seconds later, were diversionary shots. So we've got diversionary shots coming from the six-story eastern window, southeastern window, we call it. Also, there's a wonderful little-known book that was put together remarkably by Glenn Sample, who lives in Southern California now, and Mark Collum, who is deceased. But Mark, in 1968, was in the hospital in Oklahoma, prison hospital. He had gotten in some trouble, minor stuff, marijuana or something, and so he was giving them 30 days or whatever he had to, and he got sick, was in the hospital, and he ended up sharing a room, his bed, next to this Indian man named Lawrence Factor. And Lawrence Factor, this is 1968 now, nearly 5 years after the fact. And Factor is kind of wanting to tell his story and finally admits that he was on the sixth floor when Kennedy was killed. He never would admit to actually shooting anybody. He did admit to pulling a trigger and firing a diversionary shot, but I don't think Sample and Collum really believe that he didn't kill or at least shoot or try to kill Kennedy. But that being here or there, he identified Lee Oswald, he never knew Harvey, as being in a motel with him in Dallas on Wednesday, shooting, of course, being on Friday. He did some planning with that, but they kind of kept him out of the loop. He did not even know what the mission was. All he knew was he had been paid $2,000 to be there, and he would get another $8,000 when the job was over. I'm sure by the time he got up on the sixth floor and they knew the presidential motorcade was coming by, he had figured out what his job was, but he was too late then. But on that sixth floor at the western end were he and Lee and apparently LBJ's handyman, whack artist, hitman, Malcolm Wallace, who had done several jobs for Lyndon in the past and had been able to get out of it with political influence, but that's another whole story. So now we've got Lee Oswald on the sixth floor setting up Harvey, who's downstairs in the lunchroom. The shots were fired from the grassy knoll, and this is why, once again, they had to wait until the limousine reached the kill zone, which is another 200 and some odd feet down the street, less than 100 yards. And the kill zone was right where he was in perfect triangular target bullseye of the grassy knoll on the right behind the fence, his front right, the six-story western, southwestern window of the Texas School Book Depository, and the shot from the rear from the Dallas Records building. So this was the triangular team that Russell Bowen was talking about, but they weren't necessarily the same personnel. They, Chauncey Holt, who was one of the three tramps, this thing is so convoluted, people are saying, what are you talking about? Who are the tramps now? But once again, you got to read the book and see the pictures of the three phony tramps that were pulled off of the railroad car, and their shoes were too nice to be tramps, and they were too clean-shaven, and obviously they're posing as hobos. But Chauncey Holt was one of them. He was CIA most of his life, and he did admit in later years that was him in the picture. And but he said it might have been Garrison that he told that he said the Dealey Plaza looked like a spook convention. All the agents that he recognized and folks with walkie talkies in their back pockets and speaking of that, you know, the umbrella man who opened his umbrella at the moment Kennedy was first shot in the throat, the man sitting next to him on the curb, blow-ups show the walkie-talkie antenna sticking out of his pocket taller than his head. So, indeed, there was all kinds of communication going around there. Bullets were flying all over Dealey Plaza, as one reporter said. A lot more than just somebody in the depository sixth floor and in front of the fence. They were flying all over the place, and one reporter said there were at least 9 shots fired, but, you know, maybe more. So this is what happened. He was set up. It was a CIA operation from the beginning, a palace coup, I call it in the book. Definitely a coup d'etat, and I think it was the slickest operation in history, and as just as obvious a palace coup as that of Julius Caesar 2,000 years earlier. The one man, and we name him in the book, and I've corresponded with him quite a bit, he has claimed that for a long time that he was paid $30,000, and he was 21 years old at the time, and he was one of the shooters behind the fence at the grassy knoll. His name is James File. He's in jail in Illinois on some other murder charges, but he expects to be released. He's 71 or 2 this year, and he expects to be released before his, you know, he will not serve a full life sentence if he can maintain his health. I think he's supposed to get out in a couple of years. So he has promised to come see me, and so I may buy his lunch. I'm of course looking forward to that because it'll be like kind of a stepping back into history.
Well, that's a lot more than anybody I think that I've ever talked to. Information that they have put together on that, and I believe that I can't say for sure that any one of those guys were the one that did it, but I'm betting that at least two or three of them were involved directly.
Yeah. Well, Charles Rossetti was James Files' boss. He was a Chicago mobster, and he's one that was killed later. But he actually drove Files to Dallas from Chicago. And once again, there's another one. See, Rossetti was never, they never fooled with him. They never bothered with killing him until those House investigations came up in the late 70s, and suddenly he was under subpoena. And Johnny Roselli is another one. He woke up in the 55-gallon drum floating in Biscayne Bay, if you remember.
Yep.
But it was in the late 70s. It was 15 years after the fact. Why? Because they can't be trusted to go behind closed doors under oath and keep their mouths shut.
How many people would you say they knew about that they never, that the Warren Commission never subpoenaed and never questioned that had
information? Oh, John, emailed me one today that I was totally in the dark about. I didn't even realize that he gave me the information as we wrote that long dissertation where I did the bold type fill-ins on his day with the Tippit and the Oswald, the Tippit murder and the two Oswalds. You remember that part of the book?
Yes.
He has enhanced that with some additional information he just sent me today and asked for some of my feedback, and I haven't had time to do so. But I printed it out, and I'm just walking into the other office now because I want to pick it up and tell you what he pointed out to me to answer your question. Now, while I'm getting back in the light where I can see, I don't know how many. There were many that the Warren Commission ignored, and some of them obviously intentionally. But here is a three-page printout. Let me see where that one was. Okay. We're talking about after the assassination, and we're down on 10th and Patton Street about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, a half an hour after Kennedy was shot. And Tippit drove to 1026 North Beckley. That's the house where Harvey rented the room. He honked his horn and then drove around the corner. Harvey left the rooming house and was seen near the corner of Beckley and Zhang around 1:04 p.m. He may have gotten into Tippett's car and been driven to the Texas Theater. Tippit may have dropped Harvey off in the all-but-deserted alley directly behind the theater. Harvey could then walk unseen from the alley down the narrow passageway adjacent to the theater and emerge on Jefferson Boulevard close to the entrance of the theater. Harvey bought a ticket from Julia Postal and went inside the theater. Remember, now, this is where the whole time when Lee had been setting him up with Johnny Brewer at the shoe store and acting suspiciously. But once again, your listeners are going to have to get into the book to get those details. But Tippit then drove to a prearranged location near 10th and Patton, where he met up with Lee Oswald. This will be around 1:09 p.m. Tippit may have been told by his handlers that his assignment was to pick up Lee and transport him to the Texas Theater or to another location. Tippit, however, had no knowledge of Lee Oswald's real assignment. Tippit was one of the few people who knew and came in contact with both Harvey and Lee on November 22nd, and therefore had to be eliminated. This is why Tippit was killed. Lee Oswald's real assignment may have been to meet up with Tippit, kill him, which he did by shooting him in the head, and then blame the murder on Harvey, which he did by leaving his wallet at the murder scene. Now, we're coming to your question. After hurrying to the theater, Lee made sure he was noticed when he failed to buy a ticket from Julia Postal, ran inside the theater, and he went upstairs to the balcony. And by the way, somewhere in my files, I have a copy of the original police report that shows the cop actually turned in his report to Dallas PD later that Oswald, when he sneaked in the theater, he ran upstairs. And they said that's where he was arrested. The cop obviously made a mistake or else wrote it up too soon and didn't get it corrected, didn't follow instructions to point out that Oswald was actually arrested downstairs, not up. But anyway, that is in the police report. I've seen it myself. But when the police arrived, they knew who they were looking for from identification found in the wallet at the scene of Tippett's murder. Harvey was sitting in the lower level of the darkened theater and was pointed out by Tommy Rowe. Here's your guy, Terry, Tommy Rowe, but not Johnny Brewer. Tommy Rowe worked at the Hardy Shoe Store with Brewer. Rowe told friends, relatives, and JFK researchers in 1964 that it was he, not Brewer, who pointed out Harvey to the police. Rowe was a very close friend of Jack Ruby's, so close that he moved into Ruby's apartment after Ruby was jailed for killing Oswald. Rowe was never interviewed by Dallas Police, FBI, or the Warren Commission. So there's an obvious one right there. Why would he not have been interviewed? He was Jack Ruby's buddy. They didn't want to talk to him.
Well, was Ruby not in the theater also?
Yes. Yeah, he was there. And that's what George, what's his name, pointed out 15 years after the fact, but he refused to tell the Warren Commission that out of fear for his life, and I think that was very prudent on his part.
They took Harvey out the front door.
Correct. And
but
remember, that's when they were amazed that he's carrying the same ID in his wallet that he just found on the street 20 minutes earlier.
Right. So if how could he have it if he had lost it, right?
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
And you haven't mentioned the other name, but there was actually a third alias that was used by both of these men that they had IDs on themselves.
Alias. Both of them used Alec Heidel. And
right.
It made me suspect, and I have for some time, that Alec Heidel just might have been Harvey's real name from way back. Or at least maybe the name he adopted when he came to Americanize his name. Don't know. Don't know that for sure. But Alec Heidel was the one who, and by the way, was A-L-E-K, which would be the Russian spelling of Alec, too, incidentally. But Alec Heidel was the name on the FBI-monitored P.O. box that Harvey was used, well, maybe both Oswalds, who knows, but where Harvey ordered the cheap Italian Mannlicher Carcano rifle from the Chicago warehouse and where it was shipped. Back in those days, you could ship guns across the country in the mailboxes. And that leads me to another thing. You know, we talked about the abuse of Marina after the fact and how she was kept incognito for literally a couple of months or more. But she finally was confessing to anything that the FBI would ask her to. And it was some time later before she came up with the admission that, I think the first one was she admitted to taking that picture. They forced that out of her, taking that phony picture in the backyard when, if she had taken it, the only thing she had taken would have been of him. But this was not he in the picture. But it was sometime later before the FBI got her to tell them that, yes, it was her husband who took the shot at General Walker back in April of 63. I don't believe he ever did. I think that was another way of setting up Oswald. It would have been just a few days before he went to New Orleans. He went at the end of April. And I forget the exact date now, the shot in April of 63 at General Walker. But I just don't believe that he did that. I'm not saying that the shot wasn't fired at Walker. It probably was. But I think it was a false flag. I think somebody shot at Walker and intentionally missed. I mean, he's sitting there at his desk. How can you miss him with a rifle from outside the window? So I believe it was an intentional miss to set up Oswald later. And then, of course, they got Marina, after her husband is dead, to admit anything. And she did.
Well, we've got just a little over 30 minutes left to go in the show. I've got a lot of questions and some stuff I want to cover. We do have a caller with her hand up. I wanted to let everybody know that the phone lines are open, and you make sure you hit a 1 if you want to ask a question. Red's been quiet this whole time. Red, if you want to jump in, just jump in, please. I'm not ignoring you here. So please speak up if you've got anything you'd like to add. But I'm ready to go to this caller real quick, if that's okay. Area code 407, you have a live mic.
Hi, Pat, it's Mary.
Hey, Mary.
Hi. I have 2 points here. I wanted to bring attention to the Secret Service when they stepped away from the car, Kennedy's car, for only that brief period, long enough for him to get shot. And you can see when one of the agents was told to step away, he threw his arms up in the air like, what the heck, you know, when he got the order to step away. And
right.
It was
now, Mary, that's actually at Love Field. That's not down on Elm Street. That's when
really?
They're first leaving, and he thinks he's supposed to be following his assignment of maybe riding on the running board or whatever. But that video is actually when they're just gotten off the plane and the motorcade is just beginning at Love Field. They're a few miles from downtown Dallas.
Okay, but were the agents right around the car at the time that he was shot? I remember one of them running up to the back of the car after he was shot.
Right. They were all held back, as you mentioned, and as was indicated by the video, but the Secret Service car was right behind him, and that was Agent Clint Hill, who was actually Jackie's bodyguard before and after the assassination. And Clint Hill was the one who ran up and jumped on the back ladder there on the running board and pushed her back into her seat,
mm-hmm.
and actually rode there all the way to Parkland at 90 miles an hour down Stemmons Freeway.
But typically, didn't they stand on that platform on the back of the car that was meant for them to protect the, you know, stand in the way of something like that?
Yeah. In fact, in previous films, you can see them and even Clint Hill riding right on the running board and next to Jackie on one side and other agents on the other side of the president, various other shots. But they weren't there when they got around to the school book depository.
Okay, and the other thing is Zapruder just happened to know exactly where to stand to make his famous film. And he sold that to Life magazine for $50,000, and I understood that he made that contract, actually already had that contract with them, and that's why Dan Rather was there so quickly that night to view the film.
Yeah.
And then he sold the second little film for $150,000 to Time Life.
Yes, I think those figures are exactly right. They're the ones I remember, though I haven't read them in years, of those amounts. Yes, it was strange that Zapruder, who had an office only a block from there, he was a dress manufacturer, and he and his helper, secretary, whatever she was two standing up on the ledge. I have stood there myself, and it is absolutely diametrically perfect for the kill zone, to film the kill zone, as if, you know, who told him to stand there? You know, if you're going to watch the parade come by, you'd think he'd be down on the curb, you know?
Well, and I'd heard that he came out there just minutes before and knew exactly where to stand, and just minutes before he came up.
Yeah, that's a strange one, all right.
Okay,
and
that's all my points.
We can't know, but it's one more thing that we will never know, but it kind of stinks. And I would disagree that he had already contracted with them. I think that would be kind of foolish. But I would not disagree that the CIA had placed him there in order to get the film.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks for calling
good to hear
in,
from
Mary.
Okay.
Okay, thanks, Mary. See you.
Thank you.
Pat, we had another question about one of the Oswalds being involved with manufacturing of cancer with the CIA. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, that would be Harvey when he went to New Orleans in April and stayed there till October. This is where he met Judith Baker, and that was a strange meeting, too, that seemed to be set up, a timing that he would meet her or she would meet him. And Judith Baker actually had an affair with Harvey, and while they were in New Orleans, her book is called Me and Lee. I'm looking at it here on my shelf, and she's one I mentioned at the end of all my reminiscences because we were traveling in the same blocks of the French Quarter, not with the same people, however, at the same time, the summer of 63 and the fall and early 64, I was in New Orleans myself. But she was the one who was brought in from University of Florida, I believe, at Gainesville, and she worked with Dr. Alton Ochsner, who had Ochsner's clinic, a very, very famous clinic in his day in New Orleans. But Ochsner was also he was quite politically active, and he was in on the gun running to Cuba, and I suppose financing a lot of it because he was a very wealthy man. But also in on some of the assassination attempts on Castro, and this was one of them. And Judith Baker was working with at Ashton's clinic, but she's working with the little fruity guy's name, who was the airline pilot and liked boys and had no hair. Come on, Terry, help me out with the name here. I'll have to go look his picture up.
You've lost me on that one.
Okay. Well, he was also a pilot and strangely was on the phone in Houston the night of the anyway, when Garrison asked him what he was doing in Houston, he had driven there to go bowling, I think it was, or ice skating or something in Houston.
You're not talking about Clay Shaw, so.
Well, that's the Clay. Yeah, it was Clay Shaw's buddy too. Ferry, David Ferry. It just came to me.
Yeah, there you go. Right.
Okay, David Ferry and Judith Baker were working together. He had a whole lab, a laboratory set up in his house, and so this is where Oswald was pulled into it, and that's why I don't think the meeting was accidental. It seemed to be, I think she was standing in line at the post office or something and dropped her paper and he picked it up or whatever. But it seemed to be a meeting that was preset and contrived. But nevertheless, they became lovers, and he told her some things that about using different names, and just it tied in with the whole story of Armstrong and of course of I didn't get to finish with about Glenn Sample and Mark Collum and their affiliation with the Indian man Loy Factor. But come late 80s, 88, maybe 20 years or more after the fact, Mark Collum is out visiting his longtime best friend he grew up with, Glenn Sample, in California. And he gets to telling them this story about when he was in the hospital back in 68 and he met this Indian with this wild story. And Glenn said, well, heck, let's go check it out. Let's go see if we can find him. And so these two amateur sleuths uncovered some of the most penetrating facts of the case and very, very little known until like 2000. I'd say late 90s, but he finally gave them the whole story on his deathbed in 1993, and they wrote a book called The Men on the Sixth Floor. And they show in there how Factor, it was impossible for him to know some of the things about the scene at the back door, for instance, of the warehouse, because it had been remodeled since 1963, but he described it exactly as the picture showed from then. So they knew he was legit. They knew he was not lying, and they tried to trip him up time and time again and couldn't. And when they showed him the picture of Mac Wallace on his deathbed, he said, yep, that's the man I first met. That's the man who paid me the $2,000. That's the man who got me out of town and got me the other $8,000. He identified Mac Wallace. He identified Lee Oswald. He talked about being on the sixth floor and, of course, firing the shots. He never would admit that he hadn't actually shot Kennedy, but maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But he was very, very ashamed of himself, and he was very repentant and went to his deathbed, though, with the same story he had told 25 years earlier to Mark Collum. And that, of course, we cover in the book here. But I believe that that Loy Factor was there. I believe his story, and I've talked with Glenn Sample in recent months on the same thing, and he was certainly convinced. But they stumbled on several other things, such as that strange picture of Oswald at Mexico City Embassy, which is obviously not Oswald. It's somebody old enough to be his father. And who is this guy? No one has ever known, but it was another stab the CIA put to try to point out or prove that Oswald had been in Mexico City trying to get a visa.
That's one of the pieces that they can get out of your book. And how about right now telling folks how they're going to go about getting your book?
Good luck. No, sorry. probably right now, since I don't even have any in hand, they won't even be available before anybody can send me a check. which it's going to be in the next few days, the best way would be, the fastest way and easy to remember if you don't have something to write with, is just go to www.patshannon, with an A-N, not an Irish O-N, www.patshannon.us, and it's there. If you want to take advantage of Walls Over Our Minds and Terry Dodd's Super Duper Thursday Night August 1st special only, I will include Everything They Ever Told Me Was a Lie and Tupper Saucy's great book that's merged into two, The Miracle on Main Street and Roger Sherman, who inspired him from the 1780s, his Caveat Against Injustice, Tupper Saucy, merged into one book. So it's a $25 item. Everything They Ever Told Me a Lie Was a Lie is a $25 item before shipping. And, of course, the Oswald Kennedy story is a $25 item. But for a $50 bill or a phony $50 counterfeit bill or a check for $50 or a couple ounces of silver, I will include all three of them. And those who want to take advantage of that, I would say just write down this address. And that would be, send it to Oceana Management. That's like Orwell's Oceana, O-C-E-A-N-I-A, Oceana Management. And that's Suite 106. And the street number is 4290 Bells Ferry Road in Kennesaw, Georgia, 30144. One more time, Oceana Management, Suite 106, 4290 Bells Ferry Road, Kennesaw, Georgia, 30144. Send me a 50 spot, and I'll give you a lot more than your money's worth. Call it the Terry Dodd Special.
Spell Kennesaw.
K-E-N-N-E-S-A-W.
I'm posting it in the chat room here. And give me the zip one more time.
30144. Yeah, just tell them it's a Walls in the Mind special or Terry Dodd special, three for the price of two. But really,
well, I'll tell you, I've read those books and they are awesome. I had actually read the Miracle on Main Street before by Tupper Saucy, and loaned it to somebody or gave it to somebody, and was glad to get another copy. And I've read the thing again, and I think it's better the second time I read it than it was the first. So not only are your books a great value there, and I, you know, of course, I love Everything They Ever Told Me Was a Lie. My wife's reading that right now and enjoying it very much. So I really recommend everybody go for the three book deal here and either put my name on it or put Walls in Our Mind special on it. We've got about 17 minutes left here, maybe 16 minutes, and I'd really like to bring this forward like we talked about originally, let's talk about the media. Let's talk about who the players are that are still around and how this has brought us forward to today and why this is so important to understand. Can you do that?
Gosh, what players are still around after 50 years?
Yeah,
James Files in jail would be one. There'd be very, very few. That's for sure. And speaking of the media, read me that quote you put on the flyer today. I had written it, but I'd forgotten. That's a good quote. I patted myself on the back after I read that.
I'll bring it up here real quick. That's on when you go to Kendall and look up Everything They Ever Told Me Was a Lie. That quote is in there. That's where I pulled it from. And it says, it is bad enough that we cannot trust our politicians to tell us the truth, an age-old problem. But when a cooperative news media not only fails to investigate and continues to perpetuate these fabrications, even after the reported facts have long been proven wrong, a whole nation of people winds up totally confused by a corrupted few.
Yep.
Is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah, boy. I outdid myself with that one. I That's really right on. I would pat anybody on the back for saying that. I tell you, that is so accurate. But I dedicated that book to the few news people left on the street who try to be honest, but they find out their editors won't let them. That's, you know, on the first page. And I experienced this with lots of other cases. I remember when I was covering the Montana Freeman back in 1996, and I was up there in Jordan, a little burg of a few hundred people, and one cafe in town, and CBS News had commandeered the back dining room there with all their cameras and set up and their big satellites out in the parking lot. And so we had just a small place to go in and get some eggs and coffee at 6 or 7 in the morning, and the phone rang. The telephone at the phone booth was ringing right behind me, and nobody was paying much attention. The waitresses were in the kitchen, so I answered it. Turns out to be the Associated Press dude in Helena, the chief wingding, whatever you call him, and he was looking for one of his reporters who thought he might be in there having breakfast or something. Anyway, he and I struck up a conversation, and I'm there as an independent and certainly not anybody who's on the side of the feds in that situation where they had taken over the whole town and are harassing people, and it was another whole horror story, but he and I, we became friends on the telephone, and a few days later, when I was back in Billings, I saw his story in the Billings Gazette, and so I called him again, and I said, when are you guys going to start telling the truth about what's going on up here? He said, you know, I was in Jordan when you and I were talking on the phone. I don't see anything you're talking about, and I don't see anything on TV, like anything like what's going on up there. I said, how come you guys don't tell the truth? He said, Pat, I know exactly what you're talking about. He says, we do try to tell the truth. And he said, I'm amazed myself when I will put a story on the wire to AP on a Saturday, and when I read it under my own byline on Sunday, I don't even recognize it. And he was pointing out what I already knew, that, you know, there are about a half a dozen people, or at least agencies with a handful of people in each, that form the American Opinion. And these would be the people at CNN and ABC and NBC and Associated Press who decide what stories are going to reach the American people and what stories are not. And that's just the way it is. And I think the greatest shining example of that came home to me after 9/11, when most of the stuff we were learning was coming out of London and Berlin and Paris news agencies, the stuff that was suppressed in the United States, such as, you remember the FBI was boasting that only in a matter of 3 or 4 days they had pegged all 19 of the hijackers, the guys who had gone in with their box cutters and created all this havoc and hijacked the planes, and we got them. Oh, here they are. Here are their names. Here are their pictures. You saw them. Well, they would have had egg all over their faces with an honest American news reporting team to point out what we learned from the Saudi Arabian agency, that six of these guys, and I think there was a later seventh and maybe eighth, but we know six stepped forward on one day in front of the TV cameras and saying, hey, what the heck are you doing accusing me of crashing a plane into a building in New York? Here I am. I work here. I had nothing to do with that. And six of them were still alive. So this is news suppression, Terry. That's what it is, plain and simple. And so we're still living it. And as you said at the outset of the program, this is one of the reasons we've got to expose this book to give an example. The JFK assassination and the uncensored story of the two Oswalds is a shining example of government cover-up, of government murder, government hired hands, a palace coup, a coup d'etat, call it what you want. But this is the example of how they do it. It's the blueprint, and anybody who ever reads this book will never look at not only the Kennedy assassination in the same way, but will look at everything else cockeyed that comes through the news, every crisis.
Well, the same people that put the Federal Reserve into operation, the same people who were at Jekyll Island, either some of them or their family members or their bloodline or their corporate entities the J.P. Morgans, the Rockefellers, Kissinger's still out there, H.W. Bush is still out there, all the corporations, the CBSs, ABCs, and NBCs, and Disney, and all of the movie production people, the corporations that own all of the media and cable, they are still there. And they're still having the same influence. We got the same situation going on with Benghazi and the Clinton and the Bush crime families. These people have been at it for all this time, and all of this stuff leads back to the same people. And in order to understand what's going on today, people have got to study their history. Kennedy's just one of those situations. It really
true
goes
history.
All the way back. Yes. So we've got 9 minutes left. You want to let Red jump in here for 2 seconds, or you want to close us out?
Red has never jumped anywhere for only 2 seconds. But, yes, I always love to talk to my old friend. Did he go to sleep on us?
No, he usually mutes himself so that we don't hear him snoring.
Right. Well, maybe he did crash, or maybe he went to take a pill.
Now, can you hear me now?
Oh, there he is.
Yes, we do.
Yeah, I unmuted. I'll tell you, this is so much a prophecy, Bible prophecy coming true. Because Daniel, the book of Daniel in your Bible in the Old Testament, Daniel 12:4. He says that in the last days, knowledge shall increase. Knowledge has to consist of truth. And it can't be anything, it can't be any propaganda or lies. It has to be truth for knowledge. And look at the knowledge, the truth that has been coming out in just the last few weeks. All the scandal coming out of Washington, D.C., all of the, it's just absolutely amazing. And I love every bit of it, so I'll get back, I'll let you have it back. It took more than a couple seconds, but thanks, Pat, for coming on. I think we had a great program.
Okay, well, yeah, thank you. I would point out, as I did from the outset, and I never want to fail pointing this out, that the real hero of this story is John Armstrong. I've got his book under my arm now as we speak, with the pictures of the many Harveys and Lees. And it's, as I say, it's 1,000 pages of just incredible research. I mean, as I say, it's just indefatigable. And John Armstrong's book is really a collector's item now, even though he's attempting to publish it again, but it's several hundred dollars on the collector's market because it's a pretty hot number. But I see from his website he is just republishing it himself, and it looks like it's going to be available for like $65 or 60 plus shipping or something. And I would urge anyone who really wants to know the story on the JFK assassination, the real buffs, that after you order my book, of course, and read the synopsis, that should be enough to tease you into looking up and seeing if you can find John Armstrong's book if he gets it out again at a reasonable price. But it's a treasure to have on your bookshelf if you are the kind of interest that I've had the past 50 years in this case. But in any case, be sure to get a copy of the synopsis that I've done. It's like 160-something pages and just full of everything we've been talking about here tonight and all the proof. And as I said earlier, one of my favorite editions is the picture of the two mothers who are 15 years apart. And that was fun, thanks to John Armstrong and uncovering that information, and Palmer McBride, and of course all the other stuff we've talked about tonight. But I always want to give credit to John Armstrong, because he's just as I say, he's head and shoulders above everybody else who ever entered this arena. And I, as I call him in the book, he's the Babe Ruth of all the home run hitters in this league. Once again, yeah, if you want to send me $50, I'll give you more than your money's worth. I'll give you three for the price of two.
That's a great buy. Well, what have you learned that you didn't expect to learn out of your research?
You mean most recently? Because, you know, I've known Armstrong's work for over, like, 15 years. But to answer your question, the I learned of the associates that he dug up. I learned, as I mentioned, Palmer McBride and other friends of both Oswalds. I learned of the two Marguerites. I never knew that there were two Marguerites. I thought one was just posing with the two boys and being, you know, put in place and at the end, because we never knew who she was at the beginning. But that was wrong. They are of separate families. I learned that that Harvey was maybe a Russian war orphan. He certainly was of Russian parentage, and he grew up speaking both languages in New York, and both very fluently. That was evident all the time. I guess I just learned so many details, Terry, of the basics that I already knew. You know, I'd studied Garrison and his case back in the 60s, and when he couldn't even get governors of various states to cooperate in serving subpoenas. That's how strong the FBI had been in thwarting his efforts. I knew, once again, all the basics of David Ferry, whose name I couldn't think of a while ago. But I learned so many more details through the recent research and going ahead to write a book. I think it was Paul Harvey who many years ago said, if you want to learn a subject thoroughly, go write a book about it. And he's right. He was right, because you can't write a book until you get the knowledge and learn what it is you're going to be talking about.
Do you know if Lee and Harvey ever met?
Well, I asked John that precise question, and he cannot prove it. He cannot pinpoint it, as he just suggested in this last piece he sent me, that they might have been brought together very briefly by Tippett. But I don't necessarily believe that. I don't necessarily see any great evidence of it. He's speculating here, which, you know, is fine, and because there's so much speculation, it must be done on this. But he's suggesting that possibly they met right after the assassination, and I asked him just a few weeks ago if they had known each other beforehand, and he said he did not think so. He didn't believe so, and I didn't either. I couldn't find out where they had, and that's why I asked him, just probably the same reason you just asked me.
Does anybody have any idea where Lee may be today, if he's still alive?
No. He was allegedly was spotted by none other than John Armstrong and a couple of others. Another man I know in South Florida, and his name, first name was Red. He ran a fishing shop down, I forget what town now, somewhere around Orlando. And John, the story goes, actually saw this man. This would have been in the 90s. He actually saw this man leave his house and thought it was Lee Oswald. He looked enough alike, 40 years later or 35 years later to be Lee Oswald, and he saw him go to his mailbox. He was there without a camera and decided, this was on like a Friday, and decided best thing to do is be out there Monday morning and catch this guy going to work and take his picture. And when he went back on Monday morning, the house had been emptied. Nobody was there. Now, I've seen pictures of this guy they call Red, and I don't buy it. I'm not saying it's not Oswald. I just am not saying it is. I would prefer to believe, I would I would have to believe, put it that way, that Oswald was taken out of the game. Lee was taken out of the game. And I point that out in the book because of when the body was raised in 81, some of the things that identified Lee Oswald were now on that head, such as the mastoid operation that is not visible when Harvey is standing in the police station in the videos, in the news shots. The missing front tooth and this sort of stuff. Suddenly the Lee on the head.
I was about to give you a warning. We're out of time.
I noticed that. I gathered. All right. Talk to you again, my friend.
Thank you so much. Have a good night, everyone. It's been a great show. Red, good night. Good night, Kate.
Good
See
night.
Everyone next week on Walls in Our Minds.
I regard myself as a soldier. A soldier of peace.
Watching a jackass chase a dumb pack of dumb. What a show. Keeping on any shoulder that I can find. If anyone in there might change their mind, it's time to go to the real world outside with those pirate ships. Fucking sailors, dirty lips. And rule the night. They rule the night. Don't be afraid of the wicked men. There's more of us than there are of them. Come